etc. We are really in competition for resources with everyone. Our genes are competitive. As Richard Dawkins points out, natural selection proceeds by competition among the phenotypes of genes, so we literally evolved to compete, a drive that allowed our species to survive. Engaging the world through the lens of competition is deeply embedded in our animal brains. It's not enough to boost our self-image solely by our own successes. If someone we view as a peer is winning, we feel like we're losing in comparison. We benchmark ourselves to them. If their kids are doing better in school than ours, what are we doing wrong with our kids? If their company is in the news because it is about to go public, what's wrong with us that we're just inching forward in our work? We think we know the ingredients for happiness. Sonia Lubomirsky, a psychology professor at the University of California, Riverside, and a popular author on the subject of happiness, summarized several reviews of the literature on the elements we commonly consider: a comfortable income, robust health, a supportive marriage, and a lack of tragedy or trauma. Lubomirsky noted, however, that the general conclusion from almost a century of research on the determinants of well-being is that objective circumstances, demographic variables, and life events are correlated with happiness less strongly than intuition and everyday experience tell us they ought to be. By several estimates, all of these variables put together account for no more than 8 to 15% of the variance in happiness. What accounts for most of the variance in happiness is how we're doing comparatively. The breadth and depth of all that research on happiness and its implications is important, but it's beyond what we need to understand our issue with sorting others' outcomes. I encourage you to read Lubomirsky's work on the subject, Daniel Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness, and Jonathan Haidt's The Happiness Hypothesis. A consistent example of how we price our own happiness relative to others comes from a version of the party game, Would You Rather? When you ask people if they would rather earn $70,000 in 1900 or $70,000 now, a significant number choose 1900. True, the average yearly income in 1900 was about $450, so we'd be doing phenomenally well compared to our peers from 1900. But no amount of money in 1900 could buy Novocaine or antibiotics or a refrigerator or air conditioning or a powerful computer we could hold in one hand. About the only thing $70,000 bought in 1900 that it couldn't buy today was the opportunity to soar above most everyone else. We'd rather lap the field in 1900 with an average life expectancy of only 47 years than sit in the middle of the pack now with an average life expectancy of over 76 years and a computer in our palm. A lot of the way we feel about ourselves comes from how we think we compare to others. This robust and pervasive habit of mind impedes learning. Luckily, habits can be changed, whether the habit is biting your nails or decrying your terrible luck when you lose. By shifting what it is that makes us feel good about ourselves, we can move toward a more rational fielding of outcomes and a more compassionate view of others. We can learn better and be more open-minded if we work toward a positive narrative driven by engagement and truth-seeking and striving toward accuracy and objectivity. Giving others credit when it's due, admitting when our decisions could have been better, and acknowledging that almost nothing is black and white. Reshaping habit. Phil Ivey is one of those guys who can easily admit when he could have done better. Ivey is one of the world's best poker players, a player almost universally admired by other professional poker players for his exceptional skill and confidence in his game. Starting in his early 20s, he built a reputation as a top cash game player, a top tournament player, a top heads-up player, a top mixed game player, a top player in every form and format of poker. In a profession where, as I've explained, most people are awash in self-serving bias, Phil Ivey is an exception. In 2004, my brother provided televised final table commentary for a tournament in which Phil Ivey smoked a star-studded final table. After his win, the two of them went to a restaurant for dinner, during which Ivey deconstructed every potential playing error he thought he might have made on the way to victory, asking my brother's opinion about each strategic decision. A more run-of-the-mill player might have spent the time talking about how great they played, relishing the victory. Not Ivey. For him, the opportunity to learn from his mistakes was much more important than treating that dinner as a self-satisfying celebration. He earned $500,000 and won a lengthy poker tournament over world-class competition. But all he wanted to do was discuss with a fellow pro where he might have made better decisions. I heard an identical story secondhand about Ivey at another otherwise celebratory dinner following one of his now 10 World Series of Poker victories. Again, from what I understand, he spent the evening discussing, in intricate detail with some other pros, the points and hands where he could have made better decisions. Phil Ivey clearly has different habits than most poker players, and most people in any endeavor, in how he fields his outcomes. Habits operate in a neurological loop consisting of three parts: the cue, the routine, and the reward. A habit could involve eating cookies. The cue might be hunger, the routine going to the pantry and grabbing a cookie, and the reward a sugar high. Or in poker, the cue might be winning a hand, the routine taking credit for it, and the reward a boost to our ego. Charles Duhigg, in his book The Power of Habit, offers the golden rule of habit change, that the best way to deal with a habit is to respect the habit loop. Quote, "To change a habit, you must keep the old cue and deliver the old reward, but insert a new routine," end quote. When we have a good outcome, it cues the routine of crediting the result to our awesome decision-making, delivering the reward of a positive update to our self-narrative. A bad outcome cues the routine of offloading responsibility for the result, delivering the reward of avoiding a negative self-narrative update. With the same cues, we flip the routine for the outcomes of peers, but the reward is the same, feeling good about ourselves. The good news is that we can work to change this habit of mind by substituting what makes us feel good. The golden rule of habit change says we don't have to give up the reward of a positive update to our narrative, nor should we. Duhigg recognizes that respecting the habit loop means respecting the way our brain is built. Our brain is built to seek positive self-image updates. It is also built to view ourselves in competition with our peers. We can install new hardware. Working with the way our brains are built and reshaping habit has a higher chance of success than working against it. Better to change the part that is more plastic, the routine of what gives us the good feeling in our narrative, and the features by which we compare ourselves to others. At least as far back as Pavlov, behavioral researchers have recognized the power of substitution in psychological loops. In his famous experiments, his colleague noticed that dogs salivated when they were about to be fed. Because they associated a particular technician with food, the presence of the technician triggered the dog's salivation response. Pavlov discovered that dogs could learn to associate just about any stimulus with food, including his famous bell, triggering the salivary response. We can work to change the bell we ring, substituting what makes us salivate. We can work to get the reward of feeling good about ourselves from being a good credit giver, a good mistake admitter, a good finder of mistakes and good outcomes, a good learner, and, as a result, a good decision maker. Instead of feeling bad when we have to admit a mistake, what if the bad feeling came from the thought that we might be missing a learning opportunity just to avoid blame, or that we might be basking in the credit of a good result instead of, like Phil Ivey, recognizing where we could have done better? If we work toward that, we can transform the unproductive habits of mind of self-serving bias and motivated reasoning into productive ones. If we put in the work to practice this routine, we can field more of our outcomes in an open-minded, more objective way, motivated by accuracy and truth-seeking to drive learning. the habit of mind will change, and our decision-making will better align with executing on our long-term goals. There are people who, like Phil Ivey, have substituted the routine of truth-seeking for the outcome-oriented instinct to focus on seeking credit and avoiding blame. When we look at the people performing at the highest level of their chosen field, we find that the self-serving bias that interferes with learning often recedes and even disappears. The people with the most legitimate claim to a bulletproof self-narrative have developed habits around accurate self-critique. In sports, the athletes at the top of the game look at outcomes to spur further improvements. American soccer great Mia Hamm said, "Many people say I'm the best woman soccer player in the world. I don't think so. And because of that, someday I just might be." Such quotes can be discounted as a polite way of dealing with the media. There are plenty of contrary examples burned in our consciousness, like John McEnroe arguing line calls, or golf pros who have turned missed putts into a ritual of staring at the offending line of the putt and tapping down phantom spike marks. Those aren't anything more than performance tics. It's practically a ritual on the PGA Tour that if a player misses a makeable putt, he has to stare at the green like it was somehow at fault. What you don't see are practice rituals like Phil Mickelson's, in which he places 10 balls in a circle 3 feet from the hole. He has to sink all 10 and then repeat the process 9 more times. Players of Phil Mickelson's caliber couldn't engage in such a demanding regimen if they actually assigned much blame to spike marks. Changing the routine is hard and takes work, but we can leverage our natural tendency to derive some of our self-esteem by how we compare to our peers. Just as Duhigg recommends respecting the habit loop, we can also respect that we are built for competition and that our self-narrative doesn't exist in a vacuum. Keep the reward of feeling like we are doing well compared to our peers, but change the features by which we compare ourselves. Be a better credit giver than your peers, more willing than others to admit mistakes, more willing to explore possible reasons for an outcome with an open mind, even and especially if that might cast you in a bad light or shine a good light on someone else. In this way, we can feel like we are doing well by comparison because we are doing something unusual and hard that most people don't do. That makes us feel exceptional. Once we start listening for it, we hear a chorus out in the world like I heard during breaks in poker tournaments. Things are going great because I'm making such good decisions. Things went poorly because I got so unlucky. That's what the lawyer heard from his senior partner in each evening's postmortem of the trial. That's what we heard from Chris Christie in the 2016 Republican presidential debate. That's what I heard in every poker room I was ever in. There were times, and there still are, when I'm part of that chorus. Increasingly, though, I've learned to use that chorus to avoid self-serving bias rather than giving into it. When I admitted mistakes, when I recognized the luck element in my successes, when I gave other players credit for making some good decisions, when I was eager to share a hand that I thought I played poorly because I might learn something from it, that chorus reminded me that what I was doing was hard and that others weren't often doing it. Identifying learning opportunities that other players were missing made me feel good about myself, reinforcing my routine change. Ideally, we wouldn't compare ourselves with others or get a good feeling when the comparison favors us. We might adopt the mindful practices of Buddhist monks, observing the flow of inner thoughts, emotions, and bodily sensations without judging them as good or bad at all. That's a great goal, and I'm all for regular mindful practice. It will, the research indicates, help improve quality of life and is worth pursuing. But getting all the way there is a tall order if we don't want to quit our day jobs and move to Tibet. It works against the way our brains evolved, against our competitive drive. As a parallel practice, the more practical and immediate solution is to work with what we've got, using that comparison to strengthen our focus on accuracy and truth-seeking. Plus, we won't have to give up our lives and find a remote mountaintop to live on. We need a mindset shift. We need a plan to develop a more productive habit of mind. That starts in deliberative mind and requires foresight and practice. But if it takes hold, it can become an established habit, running automatically and changing the way we reflexively think. We can get to this mindset shift by behaving as if we have something at risk when we sort outcomes into the luck and skill buckets, because we do have a lot at risk on that fielding decision. Thinking in bets is a smart way to start building habits that achieve our long-term goals. Wanna bet redux. Treating outcome fielding as a bet can accomplish the mindset shift necessary to reshape habit. If someone challenged us to a meaningful bet on how we fielded an outcome, we would find ourselves quickly moving beyond self-serving bias. If we wanted to win that bet, we wouldn't reflexively field bad outcomes as all luck or good ones as all skill. If you walked into a poker room and threw around words like always and never, you'd soon find yourself challenged to a bunch of bets. It's easy to win a bet against someone who takes extreme positions. Imagine getting into an accident at an intersection after losing control of your car on a patch of ice you couldn't see. Your first thought would likely be that you got unlucky. But what if you had to bet on that? Depending on the details, there would be a lot of alternatives to just plain bad luck you would now consider. Based on the weather, maybe you could have anticipated some ice on the road. Maybe you were driving too fast for the weather conditions. Once the car started skidding, maybe you could have steered differently, or maybe you pumped the brakes when you shouldn't have. Maybe you could have taken a safer route, choosing a main road that would have been salted. Maybe you should have kept the Mustang in the garage and taken the Suburban. Some of the reasons we come up with may be easy to discount, and some may not. The key is that in explicitly recognizing that the way we field an outcome is a bet, we consider a greater number of alternative causes more seriously than we otherwise would have. That is truth-seeking. This is what Phil Ivey does. The prospect of a bet makes us examine and refine our beliefs. In this case, the belief about whether luck or skill was the main influence in the way things turned out. Betting on what we believe makes us take a closer look by making explicit what is already implicit. We have a great deal at risk in assessing why anything turned out the way it did. That sure sounds like a bet worth taking seriously. When we treat outcome fielding as a bet, it pushes us to field outcomes more objectively into the appropriate buckets, because this is how bets are won. Winning feels good. Winning is a positive update to our personal narrative. Winning is a reward. With enough practice, reinforced by the reward of feeling good about ourselves, thinking of fielding outcomes as bets will become a habit of mind. Thinking in bets triggers a more open-minded exploration of alternative hypotheses, of reasons supporting conclusions opposite to the routine of self-serving bias. We are more likely to explore the opposite side of an argument more often and more seriously, and that will move us closer to the truth of the matter. Thinking in bets also triggers perspective taking, leveraging the difference between how we field our own outcomes versus others' outcomes to get us closer to the objective truth. We know we tend to discount the success of our peers and place responsibility firmly on their shoulders for their failures. A good strategy for figuring out which way to bet would be to imagine if that outcome had happened to us. If a competitor closes a big sale, we know about our tendency to discount their skill. But if we imagine that we had been the one who closed the sale, we are more likely to find the things to give them credit for, that they did well, and that we can learn from. Likewise, when we close the big sale, let's spare a little of the self-congratulations and instead examine that great result the way we'd examine it if it had happened to somebody else. We'll be more likely to find the things we could have done even better and identify those factors that we had no control over. Perspective taking gets us closer to the truth, because that truth generally lies in the middle of the way we field outcomes for ourselves and the way we field them for others. By taking someone else's perspective, we are more likely to land in that middle ground. Once we start actively training ourselves in testing alternative hypotheses and perspective taking, it becomes clear that outcomes are rarely 100% luck or 100% skill. This means that when new information comes in, we have options beyond unquestioned confirmation or reversal. We can modify our beliefs along a spectrum because we know it is a spectrum, not a choice between opposites without middle ground. This makes us more compassionate, both towards ourselves and others. Treating outcome fielding as bets constantly reminds us outcomes are rarely attributable to a single cause, and there is almost always uncertainty in figuring out the various causes. Identifying a negative outcome doesn't have the same personal sting if you turn it into a positive by finding things to learn from it. You don't have to be on the defensive side of every negative outcome because you can recognize, in addition to things you can improve, things you did well, and things outside your control. You realize that not knowing is okay. Certainly, in exchange for losing the fear of taking blame for bad outcomes, you also lose the unadulterated high of claiming good outcomes were 100% skill. That's a trade you should take. Remember, losing feels about twice as bad as winning feels good. Being wrong feels about twice as bad as being right feels good. We are in a better place when we don't have to live at the edges. Euphoria or misery with no choices in between is not a very self-compassionate way to live. You also become more compassionate toward other people when you treat fielding outcomes as bets. When you look at the outcomes of others from their perspective, you have to ask yourself, what if that had happened to me? You come up with more compassionate assessments of other people, where bad things aren't always their fault and good things aren't always luck. You are more likely to walk in their shoes. Imagine how Bartman's life would have changed if people worked to think this way. The hard way. Thinking in bets is hard, especially initially. It has to start as a deliberative process and will feel clunky, weird, and slow. Certainly, there will be times when it doesn't make sense. Like, if you don't get a promotion at work, you're probably going to wonder how you're supposed to feel better acknowledging that so-and-so was more deserving and that you could learn a lot from them. It takes work to avoid the temptation to blame it on the boss being a jerk who doesn't know how to evaluate talent. That feeling is natural. I built my poker career out of these principles of learning and truth-seeking, yet I still catch myself falling into the self-serving bias and motivated reasoning traps. Duhigg tells us that reshaping a habit requires time, preparation, practice, and repetition. Look at other kinds of habit changes. If I had a habit of getting out of bed at midnight to eat a cookie, it takes work as well as will to change that habit. I have to identify the habit I want to change, figure out the routine to substitute, and practice that routine in deliberative mind until the habit is reshaped. I would need to stock apples in the house and keep them more readily available than cookies. Then I need to actually eat the apple at midnight instead of reaching for the cookie, repeating this routine until it becomes a new habit. That takes work and willpower and time. Despite the difficulties, striving for accuracy through probabilistic thinking is a worthwhile routine to pursue. For one thing, it won't always be so difficult. We have to start doing this with deliberation and effort, but it eventually becomes a habit of mind. Just like declaring uncertainty in your beliefs, it eventually goes from a somewhat goofy and awkward extra step to a habit integral to how you view the world around you. To be sure, thinking in bets is not a miracle cure. Thinking in bets won't make self-serving bias disappear or motivated reasoning vanish into thin air. But it will make those things better. And a little bit better is all we need to transform our lives. If we feel just a few extra outcomes more accurately, if we catch just a few extra learning opportunities, it will make a huge difference in what we learn, when we learn, and how much we learn. Poker's compressed version of real-world decision-making showed me how being a little better at decision-making could make a big difference. A poker game can consist of a few hundred hands. Every hand can require up to 20 decisions. If over the course of the game there were 100 outcomes that provided learning opportunities, and we caught 10 of them, we would still be missing 90% of our chances to learn. We wouldn't have transcended the way our brains function and built ourselves a different brain, but we don't need to. If our opponents are people like Nick the Greek, they are missing almost every learning opportunity. We're obviously going to do better than they do, just catching 10%. If another of our opponents is someone just like us, but who isn't working to transform their outcome processing routines, maybe they, this prior version of ourselves, will pick up 5 opportunities. Again, we are missing 90%, and we are still going to clean up on an opponent who is trying to learn but doesn't know how. The benefits of recognizing just a few extra learning opportunities compound over time. The cumulative effect of being a little better at decision-making, like compounding interest, can have huge effects in the long run on everything that we do. When we catch that extra occasional learning opportunity, it puts us in a better position for future opportunities of the same type. Any improvement in our decision quality puts us in a better position in the future. Think of it like a ship sailing from New York to London. If the ship's navigator introduces a 1-degree navigation error, it would start off as barely noticeable. Unchecked, however, the ship would veer farther and farther off course and would miss London by miles, as that 1-degree miscalculation compounds mile over mile. Thinking in bets corrects your course, and even a small correction will get you more safely to your destination. The first step is identifying the habit of mind that we want to reshape and how to reshape it. The first step is hard and takes time and effort and a lot of missteps along the way. So the second step is recognizing that it is easier to make these changes if we aren't alone in the process. Recruiting help is key to creating faster and more robust change, strengthening and training our new truth-seeking routines. Chapter 4, The Buddy System. Maybe you're the problem, do you think? When Lauren Conrad, star of MTV's The Hills, appeared on The Late Show with David Letterman in October 2008, her interview took an unexpected turn. The first minute was standard talk show banter for a 22-year-old star of a successful reality series, the amount of drama in her life. Less than a minute later, Conrad asked Letterman if he was calling her an idiot. She started off the interview by discussing her ongoing feud with her by-then former roommate, Heidi Montag, and Heidi's boyfriend, Spencer Pratt. In case you're not familiar, here is the backstory. Lauren and Heidi's friendship ended when they came to blows at a birthday party after Lauren accused Heidi and Spencer of starting rumors that she had made a sex tape. In addition, Lauren developed friendships with Stephanie, Spencer's sister, and Holly, Heidi's sister, complicating the social and family encounters of everyone involved. Lauren tried without success to strengthen the relationship between her roommates, Audrina and Lo. This strained Lauren's friendship with Audrina, who reestablished her friendship with Heidi. Brody Jenner was also in the mix, dating Lauren, questioning her date with a Teen Vogue model, dating someone else himself, arguing with Spencer about his friendship with Lauren, getting accused of starting the rumors about Lauren's sex tape, etc. All of that drama happening in Conrad's life is what David Letterman was referring to when he interjected. That raises the question. Maybe you're the problem. Do you think? That quip sent an interview that was supposed to be a puffy, promotional chat into an uncomfortable tailspin. Letterman immediately realized that he had taken the conversation into much deeper, more serious territory than either of them could have anticipated. He tried to soften the blow in a self-deprecating way, adding that he had done the same thing for years, refusing to close the learning loop by assuming everybody around him was an idiot. Letterman said, "Let me give you an example from my own life. For a long time, I thought, geez, people are idiots. Then it occurred to me, is it possible that everybody's an idiot? Maybe I'm the idiot. And it turns out, I am. Conrad clearly didn't want to hear it, replying, does that make me an idiot then? Websites devoted to reality TV, gossip, media, and popular culture immortalized the moment, and that's how they saw it. Gawker.com said Letterman basically calls Conrad an idiot. TrendHunter.com thought Letterman ripped into Conrad. Star Pulse's take, Letterman makes fun of Lauren Conrad. Letterman's comment was actually quite perceptive. His mistake was offering up the insight in an inappropriate forum to someone who hadn't agreed to that kind of truth-seeking exchange. Conrad certainly had a lot of drama in her life, enough that MTV created two successive shows to document it. But like most people do, she characterized the drama as a series of things happening to her. In other words, the drama was outside her control. Luck. Letterman suggested some of it could be fielded into the skill bucket, a suggestion that might have been helpful to Conrad in the future if she had been receptive to it. Not surprisingly, she wasn't. Letterman had offered the helpful alternative hypothesis unexpectedly on a late-night talk show where the norm is fluff and PR. Perhaps Letterman's approach would have been more appropriate in an Oprah Winfrey-style prime-time interview, or on one of those reality therapy shows where reality stars agree to such an exchange. As it was, he violated the assumed social contract by challenging Conrad to bet on her outcome fielding when she hadn't agreed to truth-seek with him. That exchange was similar to my interaction at the poker tournament with the 6-7 of Diamonds guy. I thought he was asking for my advice, so I responded by asking for more information to get an idea of whether he accurately fielded his losing outcome as luck. He was expecting me to adhere to the norm of being a sympathetic ear for a hard luck story. When I attempted to delve into the details, I violated this implied contract. I Lettermaned him. Such interactions are reminders that not all situations are appropriate for truth-seeking, nor are all people interested in the pursuit. That being said, any of us who wants to get better at thinking in bets would benefit from having more David Lettermans in our lives. As the original Letterman learned from the awkward exchange with Lauren Conrad, Lettermaning needs agreement by both parties to be effective. The red pill or the blue pill? In the classic science fiction film, The Matrix, when Neo, played by Keanu Reeves, meets Morpheus, the hero hacker, played by Lawrence Fishburne, Neo asks Morpheus to tell him what the Matrix is. Morpheus offers to show Neo, giving him the choice between taking a blue pill and a red pill. Morpheus says, you take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. As Neo reaches toward a pill, Morpheus reminds him, remember, all I am offering is the truth, nothing more. Neo chooses to see the world as it really is. He takes the red pill and is pounded with a series of devastating truths. His comfortable world is a dream created by machines to enslave him as an energy source. His job and lifestyle, his clothes, his appearance, and the entire fabric of his life are an illusion implanted in his brain. In the actual world, taking the red pill causes his body to be unplugged from his feeding pod, flushed into a sewer, and picked up by Morpheus's pirate ship, the Nebuchadnezzar. As rebels against the machines, Morpheus and his crew, and now Neo, due to his choice, live in cramped quarters, sleep in uncomfortable cells, eat gruel, and wear rags. Machines are out to destroy them. The trade-off is that Neo sees the world as it actually is, and in the end, gets to defeat the machines that have enslaved humanity. In the movie, the Matrix was built to be a more comfortable version of the world. Our brains, likewise, have evolved to make our version of the world more comfortable. Our beliefs are nearly always correct. Favorable outcomes are the result of our skill. There are plausible reasons why unfavorable outcomes are beyond our control. And we compare favorably with our peers. we deny, or at least dilute, the most painful parts of the message. Giving that up is not the easiest choice. Living in the matrix is comfortable. So is the natural way we process information to protect our self-image in the moment. By choosing to exit the matrix, we are asserting that striving for a more objective representation of the world, even if it is uncomfortable at times, will make us happier and more successful in the long run. But it's a trade-off that isn't for everyone. It must be freely chosen to be productive and sustainable. Morpheus, unlike Letterman, didn't just go around ripping people out of the matrix against their will. He asked Neo to make the choice and exit the matrix with him. If you have gotten this far in this book, I am guessing that you are choosing the red pill over the blue pill. When I started playing poker, I chose truth-seeking. Like Neo, I did it reluctantly, and I wasn't sure what I was getting into. My brother took a blunt approach with me. My instinct was to complain about my bad luck and to marvel at how poorly others played, decrying the injustice of any hand I might have lost. He wanted to talk about where I had questions about my strategic decisions, where I felt I might have made mistakes, and where I was confused on what to do in a hand. I recognized he was passing along the approach he learned with his friends, a group of smart, analytical East Coast players, many of whom, like Eric Seidel, were on their way to establishing themselves as legends of the game. In addition to introducing me to this approach, he also encouraged these phenomenal professionals to treat me as a peer when discussing poker. I was lucky to have access at such an early stage in my career to this group of world-class players who became my learning pod in poker. And I was also lucky that if I wanted to engage that group about poker, I had to ask about my strategic decisions. I had to resist my urge to moan about my bad luck and focus instead on where I felt I might have made mistakes and where I was confused on what to do in a hand. Because I agreed to the group's rules of engagement, I had to learn to focus on the things I could control, my own decisions, let go of the things I couldn't, luck, and work to be able to accurately tell the difference between the two. I learned from this experience that thinking in bets was easier if I had people to help me. Even Neo needed help to defeat the machines. Remember the buddy system from school field trips or camp? Teachers or counselors would pair everybody up with a buddy. Our buddy was supposed to keep us from wandering off or getting into water too deep, and we did the same for our buddy. A good decision group is a grown-up version of the buddy system. To be sure, even with help, none of us will ever be able to perfectly overcome our natural biases in the way that we process information. I certainly never have. But if we can find a few people to choose to form a truth-seeking pod with us and help us do the hard work connected with it, it will move the needle, just a little bit, but with improvements that accumulate and compound over time. We will be more successful in fighting bias, seeing the world more objectively, and as a result, we will make better decisions. Doing it on our own is just harder. Members of our decision pod could be our friends or members of our family, or an informal pod of coworkers, or an enterprise strategy group, or a professional organization where members can talk about their decision making. Forming or joining a group where the focus is on thinking in bets means modifying the usual social contract. It means agreeing to be open-minded to those who disagree with us, giving credit where it's due, and taking responsibility where it's appropriate, even and especially when it makes us uncomfortable. That's why when we do it with others, we need to make it clear the social contract is being modified, or feelings will get hurt, defensiveness will rear its ugly head, and just like Lauren Conrad, your audience won't want to hear what you have to say. So while we find some people to think in bets with us, with the rest of the world, it is generally better to observe the prevailing social contract and not go around saying, "Wanna bet willy-nilly." That doesn't mean we can't ever engage in truth-seeking outside of our group. Our approach just needs to be less head-on, less Letterman-like. More on that later, after we explore communications within the group. Out in the world, groups form all over the place because people recognize how others can help us. The concept of working together on our individual challenges is a familiar one. Having the help of others provides many decision-making benefits, but one of the most obvious is that other people can spot our errors better than we can. We can help others in our pod overcome their blind spot bias, and they can help us overcome the same. Whatever the obstacles to recruiting people into a decision group, and this chapter points out several along with strategies for overcoming them, it is worth it to get a buddy to watch your back or your blind spot. The fortunate thing is that we need to find only a handful of people willing to do the exploratory thinking necessary for truth seeking. In fact, as long as there are three people in the group, as Phil Tetlock says, two to disagree and one to referee, the truth-seeking group can be stable and productive. It's also helpful to recognize that people serve different purposes in our lives. Even if we place a high value on truth-seeking, that doesn't mean everybody in our lives has to adopt that or communicate with us in that way. Truth-seeking isn't a cult. We don't have to cut off people who don't share that commitment. Our Pilates friends or our football friends or any of our friends shouldn't have to take the red pill to remain our friends. Different friends fill different needs, and not all of them need to be cut from the same cloth. Those different groups can also provide much-needed balance in our lives. After all, it takes effort to acknowledge and explore our mistakes without feeling bad about ourselves, to forego credit for a great result, and to realize with an open mind that not all our beliefs are true. Truth-seeking flies in the face of a lot of comfortable behaviors. It's hard work, and we need breaks to replenish our willpower. In fact, in my poker strategy group, we understood the need to occasionally opt out and offload intense emotions before engaging the work of accurately fielding an outcome. If, for example, one of us just got eliminated from a tournament, it was acceptable, every once in a while, to say, "For right now, I just need to moan about my bad luck." The key was that when we did that, we recognized it was a temporary exception from the hard work we were doing together and to which we would return when the emotional rawness of the moment passed. We know our decision-making can improve if we find other people to join us in truth-seeking. And we know we need an agreement. But what's in that agreement? What are the features of a productive decision-making pod? The remainder of this chapter is devoted to offering answers to those questions. Chapter 5 builds on that by providing a blueprint for rules of engagement within truth-seeking groups, how to keep the group from drifting off course, and the productive habits of mind the group can reinforce in each of us. Not all groups are created equal. A well-chartered group can be particularly useful for habits that are difficult to break or change. This is not a crazy or even novel idea. We are all familiar with how the group approach can help with reshaping habits involving eating, consuming alcohol, and physical activity. The most well-known example of a productive group approach is Alcoholics Anonymous. The first of AA's founders, Bill W., initially refrained from drinking through a difficult process that included years of failure, hopelessness, hospitalization, drugs, and a transformative religious experience. To maintain sobriety, however, he realized that he needed to talk to another alcoholic. Bill W. recruited Dr. Bob, the second founder of AA, on a trip to Akron, Ohio. Dr. Bob, considered by family and doctors to be a hopeless and incurable alcoholic, kept Bill W. from drinking on the trip. In turn, Bill W. eventually helped Dr. Bob give up drinking. AA has subsequently helped millions of people get and stay sober and led to organizations trying the same approach with other difficult-to-tackle habits like narcotics abuse, smoking, unhealthy eating, and abusive relationships. That all sprang from the concept that we can do better with the help of others. But while a group can function to be better than the sum of the individuals, it doesn't automatically turn out that way. Being in a group can improve our decision quality by exploring alternatives and recognizing where our thinking might be biased. But a group can also exacerbate our tendency to confirm what we already believe. Philip Tetlock and Jennifer Lerner, leaders in the science of group interaction, described the two kinds of group reasoning styles in an influential 2002 paper. Quote, Whereas confirmatory thought involves a one-sided attempt to rationalize a particular point of view, exploratory thought involves even-handed consideration of alternative points of view, end quote. In other words, confirmatory thought amplifies bias, promoting and encouraging motivated reasoning because its main purpose is justification. Confirmatory thought promotes a love and celebration of one's own beliefs, distorting how the group processes information and works through decisions, the results of which can be groupthink. Exploratory thought, on the other hand, encourages an open-minded and objective consideration of alternative hypotheses and a tolerance of dissent to combat bias. Exploratory thought helps the members of a group reason toward a more accurate representation of the world. Without an explicit charter for exploratory thought and accountability to that charter, our tendency when we interact with others follows our individual tendency, which is toward confirmation. The expression echo chamber instantly conjures up the image of what results from our natural drift toward confirmatory thought. That was the chorus I heard among some groups of players during breaks of poker tournaments. When one player brought up how unlucky they had gotten, another would nod in assent as a prelude to telling their own hard luck story, which in turn would be nodded at and assented to by the group. Lerner and Tetlock offer insight into what should be included in the group agreement to avoid confirmatory thought and promote exploratory thought. Quote, complex and open-minded thought is most likely to be activated when decision makers learn, prior to forming any opinions, that they will be accountable to an audience. A, whose views are unknown. B, who is interested in accuracy. C, who is reasonably well-informed. And D, who has a legitimate reason for inquiring into the reasons behind participants' judgments / choices, end quote. Their 2002 paper was one of several they co-authored supporting the conclusion that groups can improve the thinking of individual decision makers when the individuals are accountable to a group whose interest is in accuracy. In addition to accountability and an interest in accuracy, the charter should also encourage and celebrate a diversity of perspectives to challenge biased thinking by individual members. Jonathan Haidt, a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business, is a leading expert in exploring group thought in politics. Haidt, in his book The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, built on Tetlock's work, connecting it with the need for diversity. Quote, if you put individuals together in the right way, such that some individuals can use their reasoning powers to disconfirm the claims of others, and all individuals feel some common bond or shared fate that allows them to interact civilly, you can create a group that ends up producing good reasoning as an emergent property of the social system. This is why it's so important to have intellectual and ideological diversity within any group or institution whose goal is to find truth, end quote. In combination, the advice of these experts in group interaction adds up to a pretty good blueprint for a truth-seeking charter. One, a focus on accuracy over confirmation, which includes rewarding truth-seeking, objectivity, and open-mindedness within the group. Two, accountability, for which members have advance notice. And three, openness to a diversity of ideas. An agreement along these lines creates a common bond and shared fate among members, allowing the group to produce sound reasoning. None of this should be surprising to anyone who recognizes the benefits of thinking in bets. We don't win bets by being in love with our own ideas. We win bets by relentlessly striving to calibrate our beliefs and predictions about the future to more accurately represent the world. In the long run, the more objective person will win against the more biased person. In that way, betting is a form of accountability to accuracy. Calibration requires an open-minded consideration of diverse points of view and alternative hypotheses. Wrapping all that into your group's charter makes a lot of sense. The charter of the group must be communicated unambiguously, as Eric Seidel made clear to me. I had met Eric when I was a teenager, but when I started running into him at poker tournaments, it was the first time we were interacting in a business setting. Early on in my career, I saw Eric during a break in a tournament and started moaning to him about my bad luck and losing a big hand. In three sentences, he laid out all the elements of a productive group charter. I don't want to hear it. I'm not trying to hurt your feelings, but if you have a question about a hand, you can ask me about strategy all day long. I just don't think there's much purpose in a poker story if the point is about something you had no control over, like bad luck. When you think about a charter for truth-seeking interactions, Eric Seidel pretty much nailed it. He told me the rules of being in a pod with him. He discouraged me from confirmatory or biased thought like, I got unlucky. He encouraged me to find things I might have control over and how to improve decisions about those. I knew he would hold me accountable to these things in future interactions. We would explore diverse ideas because he insisted that be the focus of our interactions. Because I was lucky enough to be part of a group with a truth-seeking charter, there was no question that my poker decision-making improved. When I could consult them on in-progress decisions like whether to move up in stakes or bankroll management or game selection, their advice reduced the number of errors I was making. Likewise, access to their range of strategies and experiences improved the quality of my thinking and decisions on a continuing basis. When I had questions or didn't understand why something happened, they would see things I didn't. When they had questions or needed advice on a hand, I wasn't just helping them work through a decision they made, but would often get insights into my own game. Those interactions led to improvements in my game I would have overlooked or, at best, figured out on my own only after making a lot of costly errors. Even better, interacting with similarly motivated people improves the ability to combat bias, not just during direct interactions, but when we are making and analyzing decisions on our own. The group gets into our head in a good way, reshaping our decision habits. The group rewards focus on accuracy. We all want to be thought well of, especially by people we respect. Lerner and Tetlock recognize that our craving for approval is incredibly strong and incentivizing. In most laboratory situations, they noted, study participants expected to explain their actions to someone they'd never met and never expected to meet again. Quote, "What is remarkable about this literature is that, despite the prevalence of these minimalist manipulations, participants still reliably respond as if audience approval matters," end quote. It's great to get approval from people we respect, but we crave approval so badly, we'll still work to get it from a stranger. A productive decision group can harness this desire by rewarding accuracy and intellectual honesty with social approval. Motivated reasoning and self-serving bias are two habits of mind that are deeply rooted in how our brains work. We have a huge investment in confirmatory thought, and we fall into these biases all the time without even knowing it. Confirmatory thought is hard to spot, hard to change, and if we do try changing it, hard to self-reinforce. It is one thing to commit to rewarding ourselves for thinking in bets, but it is a lot easier if we get others to do the work of rewarding us. Groups like AA demonstrate how a supportive group can provide the reward for doing the hard work of changing a habit routine, just by its approval. For engaging in the difficult work involved in sobriety, local AA groups give tokens or chips celebrating the length of individual members' sobriety. The tokens, which members often carry or customize as jewelry, are a tangible reminder that others acknowledge you are accomplishing something difficult. There are chips marking 1 to 65 years of sobriety. There are also chips given for every month of sobriety in the first year. There is even a chip given for being sober for 24 hours. I experienced firsthand the power of a group's approval to reshape individual thinking habits. I got my fix by trying to be the best credit giver, the best mistake admitter, and the best finder of mistakes and good outcomes. The reward was their enthusiastic engagement and deep dives, introducing me to the nuances of poker strategy. It was also rewarding to have these intelligent, successful players take my questions seriously and increasingly ask for my opinions. In contrast, I felt disapproval from them when I acted against the charter and complained about my bad luck, or expected them to confirm how great I played simply because I was winning. While I never got close to attaining the goal of a pure focus on accuracy, my group helped me give a little more credit than I otherwise would have, to spot a few more mistakes than I would have spotted on my own, to be more open-minded to strategic choices that I disagreed with. That moved me, even just a little bit at a time, toward my goal of getting closer to the objective truth. And that little bit had a huge long-run impact on my success. When I started playing poker, quote-unquote discussing hands consisted mostly of my complaining about bad luck when I lost. My brother quickly got sick of my moaning. He laid down the law and said I was only allowed to ask him about hands that I had won. If I wanted him to engage with me, I had to identify some point in those hands where I might have made a mistake. Talking about winning, even if we are identifying mistakes along the way to a win, is less painful than talking about losing, allowing new habits to be more easily trained. Identifying mistakes in hands I won reinforced the separation between outcomes and decision quality. These discussions also made me feel good about analyzing and questioning my decisions because of the approval I got from Howard and the players I looked up to. I used that approval as evidence that I understood the game and had promise as a player. When they complimented me for finding alternative approaches in my winning hands or understanding the contribution of luck, that felt terrific. In time, I could expand this approach to identifying learning opportunities in any hand I played, not just the winning ones. Once we are in a group that regularly reinforces exploratory thought, the routine becomes reflexive, running on its own. Exploratory thought becomes a new habit of mind, the new routine, and one that is self-reinforced. In a Pavlovian way, after enough approval from the group for doing the hard work of thinking and bets, we get the same good feeling from focusing on accuracy on our own. We internalize the group's approval, and as a matter of habit, we begin to do the kind of things that would earn it when we are away from the group, which is, after all, most of the time. 100 White Castles and a large chocolate shake. How accountability improves decision-making. David Gray is a high-stakes poker player and professional gambler, and a good friend. After a night at a racetrack in a bowling alley in New Jersey, David and a bunch of other bettors were hungry. It was late. Someone suggested White Castle. A discussion broke out about how many burgers the biggest eater in the group, Ira the Whale, could eat. When they got Ira the Whale to say he could eat 100 burgers, remember, White Castle burgers are small, most of the group, not surprisingly, wanted to bet against him. David was an exception. As he said to me, I was a young guy just getting started. $50 was a big win or loss for me. There was about $2,000 out against Ira the Whale. I bet $200 on him because I thought he could do it. When they got to White Castle, Ira the Whale decided to order the burgers 20 at a time. David knew he was a lock to win as soon as Ira the Whale ordered the first 20, because Ira the Whale also ordered a milkshake and fries. After finishing the 100 burgers, and after he and David collected their bets, Ira the Whale ordered another 20 burgers to go for Mrs. Whale. Accountability is a willingness or obligation to answer for our actions or beliefs to others. A bet is a form of accountability. If we're in love with our own opinions, it can cost us in a bet. Ira the Whale held the other gamblers accountable for their beliefs about whether he could eat 100 White Castle burgers. Accountability is why John Hennigan, briefly, moved to Des Moines. After spending time in that kind of environment, you become hyper-vigilant about your level of confidence in your beliefs. No one is forced to make or take such bets, but the prospect is a reminder that you can always be held accountable for the accuracy of what you believe and say. It is truly putting your money where your mouth is. Being in an environment where the challenge of a bet is always looming works to reduce motivated reasoning. Such an environment changes the frame through which we view disconfirming information, reinforcing the frame change that our truth-seeking